Lives of the Mind explores the passions and pursuits of liberal arts professors. It is sponsored by Augustana's Austin E. Knowlton Honors Program, which aims to enhance the college's mission as a liberal arts institution through an interdisciplinary course of study, as well as by cultivating intellectual curiosity and encouraging lifelong learning. I'm Christian Elliott.
And I'm Mara Carr.
And today on the show, we have Dr. Adam Call, professor of anthropology at Augustana College. Dr. Call, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, yeah.
So to start off, I guess I just want to dip into your background. How did you decide on anthropology as a field slash study and career?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was, I guess it was the summer after I graduated from high school, and I was trying to decide what courses to take in the fall. And I was having a conversation with my parents, and I was saying that I was kind of interested in learning about Native American people. You know, I knew nothing about American Indians, but I was interested. I was curious. So it was my mother who said, oh, you should take an anthropology class. So that was the first time I remember hearing the word, actually. So I signed up for an intro to anthropology class in the fall. And within, I think, a few weeks, I'd approached the professor and asked how to declare a major. I knew exactly that this was the thing I wanted to do. And she actually made me wait a little bit longer. She said, wait till the end of the course, maybe you'll change your mind. But I absolutely did not change my mind. I declared as soon as I could. And I've been studying it ever since. And I always figured I'll just keep studying it until somebody tells me to stop. And here I am. Nobody told me to stop. So, yeah.
That's really interesting.
So tell us a little bit about the research you did in your graduate program for your PhD.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out a topic to study and a place to study, because in anthropology, we study, you know, the diversity of cultures all over the world. So you can do an anthropology of pretty much any topic and in, you know, set in any place around the world. And I have lots of different interests. So when I was looking around for PhD programs, it really came down to three big major projects, depending on where I went and who I worked with as an advisor. And so, you know, one project was I might have done studies about land rights issues on American Indian reservations in northern Minnesota and the conflicts between white settlers and their families and American Indian peoples. Another project, I thought about going to Iceland and studying the fishing industry there, actually, of all things. And then I had taken, after my undergraduate years, I'd taken a backpacking holiday in Europe, and my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, we backpacked through Ireland. And that was in the mid to late 90s when tourism was really taking off. It was really booming there. And so that had become the primary industry, really, in Ireland. And it just seemed to me that there was a kind of, I don't know, commodification, I guess is the word that comes to mind, of Irish culture. It almost felt like Irish people were sort of selling a version of their culture to the tourists in a way. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, what does that do to a culture when outsiders come in and want to experience your culture as kind of part of the package product in a way? So that was the idea I kind of settled on for my PhD program and my study. So once I started looking into it, my PhD advisor, Tammy Cohn, you know, smartly said, well, you need to narrow that down. That's huge. So being a musician myself, I thought, why don't I study traditional Irish music and use that as a kind of a way to get at how maybe the tourism industry is turning Irishness into a kind of commodity. So based on that idea, narrowing it down to that topic, I chose a field site in the west of Ireland, where in this little village called Doolin, where two things happen in huge volumes. One is tourism. It's their primary industry in this little village, and traditional Irish music sessions in the pubs. And so this was a perfect location to carry out that study. So I did that for a year, a little over a year, about 14 months, my wife and I lived in this village and did what we call participant observation. So you live in the place, you work alongside people, you do what the local people do. I took lessons. I learned a couple of tunes, Irish traditional tunes, but I never really got very good at it. You know, they play really, really fast in the pubs. But, you know, I kind of played along with people. And lots of interviews. I did a lot of interviews with musicians, with tourists, with all sorts of people who were living there and passing through. And that kind of formulated the study that I ended up doing, and later my first book, which is called Turning the Tune. And because of that, that's how I got interested in other topics. Like, now I'm working with street performers in cities like Galway and Dublin, and at the Cliffs of Moher. And the Cliffs of Moher is about 2 kilometers away from the little village where I lived. And there's a lot of tourism there. It's a beautiful natural site, really dramatic kind of setting. And so one of the things about it is that it's also, unfortunately, a suicide black spot. So it's sort of known as a place where people go. They travel there to commit suicide. And also, actually, frighteningly, occasionally people accidentally slip off the edge, even tourists. And so occasionally, not every year, but, you know, it's not uncommon for several people a year to die at this site. So that's kind of what led me to my most recent project, where we put together a book called Leisure and Death, where it's all sorts of situations where leisure practices like tourism collide headlong with risk, death, and dying. So, yeah, that's a bit about my kind of research trajectory over the last number of years.
Honestly, that's really interesting. Is the, would you call it a blackout suicide area?
Yeah, a black spot. A suicide black spot is a place that's, you know, quite well known for, as a destination where people actually go to try or to complete suicide. So, you know, a famous one in the United States, sadly, is the Golden Gate Bridge, where people, you know, it's kind of known as this iconic site, you know, and a tourist site, but it's also a place where people go to jump, you know, so it's pretty sad juxtaposition between something really horrifying and tragic and something beautiful and leisurely. Mm-hmm. So,
is the one in Ireland like a large bluff?
It's a massive 11-kilometer-long set of cliffs that are, I believe, over 700 feet tall. And it's a sheer rock face of black shale. So it's a really dramatic sight. It's very beautiful. And that's why a million or more tourists go there every year to take photographs. It's become this very iconic Irish landscape. So, you know, maybe something equivalent, you know, when you see a commercial in the States for beer or, you know, Ford F-150 or something, you want to show images of Americanness, and you might show images of iconic American landscapes. Well, in the Irish context, the Cliffs of Moher are certainly one of those iconic landscapes that everybody knows. It sort of is a symbol of Irishness in a way. So it's a very important site to the Irish people. It's a very important site in the tourism industry, and sadly, it's become a very important site in terms of, you know, people trying or completing suicide.
So you mentioned your new book coming out about leisure and death. I'm curious how you decided to juxtapose leisure and death with these different anthropological accounts. How did that idea come about?
Well, it's, you know, in anthropology, we are a social science, and we like to say that we are, you know, we focus primarily on observation. So we really take ourselves to the social settings that we study, and we observe it just like, you know, for example, ecologists would have done in the old days of, you know, 1800s kind of biology. I mean, Darwin himself was observing the natural world, and then, you know, sort of coming to conclusions from the observations he was making. You know, Jane Goodall is another example of that kind of method in the biological sciences. In the social sciences, we're really the ones, I think, who use that as the primary method the most. So having done the previous work on a very leisurely topic, music and tourism in Ireland, you know, I had been doing that work. But this is something I had noticed kind of around the periphery of the thing I was focused on. It was just something that was there. You know, I kind of heard about it. I talked to people about this sort of tragic situation that was just right next to the village I was living in. So, and I just began to think about how strange that juxtaposition was. You have this really light, leisurely practice of tourism, and people are kind of having family vacations at this site and, you know, joking around and having a nice lunch. very light kind of thing. And yet there's this kind of heavy darkness to this place too, that kind of casts a shadow over the place. And that's part of the place's story as well. And so really that was what kind of drew me to start writing about it. And I actually started writing sort of free writing and doing some research on the topic and the history of the place. And I think I had a 20 or 25 page essay before I even knew what it was about. I thought, this is interesting. There's something interesting here, but I'm not sure what the argument is. And it took me a long time to actually figure out what the argument was that was coming out of this interesting observation that I guess, you know, was just there. Right. So based on that, we put together a colleague of mine, Jonathan Skinner, who's at the University of London, Roehampton. He and I put together a panel at our big national conference. And we invited people to come give papers on other interesting, sad, tragic, but not always tragic, juxtapositions between leisurely light things and death and risk and death and dying. So we had all sorts of papers that eventually turned into the collection of essays in this forthcoming book. So, and we invited other people after that as well. So we have, I think, 12 chapters on different topics within the book. So,
within your research with the Black Spot in Ireland, were you interviewing locals?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, I've been, I guess, hanging out in that region of Ireland since 2002. So 15, 16 years. So I know a lot of people in the village there and just the kind of general region. And yeah, I conducted interviews with local people, people who work at the site. Yeah, so lots of people over the years, for sure.
Were they weary of you like kind of snooping around, or were they kind of like open about it?
Yeah, I mean, in anthropology, we have to be very open. It's part of our ethics of doing field work. So you have to be very open about the kinds of work you're doing. You know, and if people don't want you to interview them, of course, or use a conversation you've had with them, you know, that's kind of immediately off limits. We have a kind of Hippocratic oath, I suppose, in anthropology that, you know, our baseline ethical idea is that you do no harm. So yeah, you always want to protect the individuals that you're studying. So yeah, and with, especially with a sensitive topic like this, I mean, you have to be very careful about, you know, how people feel about these things. And, you know, in Ireland, suicide, like in most places, suicide is a very sensitive topic. It was actually, in fact, not only seen as a mortal sin in the Catholic Church, of course, in Southern Ireland is a very kind of Catholic-oriented culture, but it was actually even illegal. So you were kind of punished sort of in this life and the next. Until recently, that law was revoked, actually. So the family almost was punished. So it's a very sensitive topic, mm-hmm. actually, in any culture, but in Ireland in particular. So yeah, you have to be very wary of writing in a respectful way about these topics. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's actually one of the things that Jonathan and I were concerned with quite a bit, actually, when we were putting this volume together, and all of our authors were too, that we handle the topic of death in a pretty serious way, you know, that we don't want to sort of turn it into a kind of celebration of the macabre. You know, it's not something that we think is cool or whatever. We want to really treat these topics very respectfully. So, and in fact, I mean, very sadly, one of our authors passed away during the production of the book. So we were very happy to include his essay. It's probably one of the final pieces he was able to produce. But that brings it home in a very real way that, you know, you want to treat the topic very sensitively.
I think that's really interesting that you took that standpoint of kind of like making it very like stark, almost like, and like respecting those mm-hmm. who were committed suicide at the site, because that's totally opposite of what like the Irish culture was kind of going through at that moment with all this tourism, because they mm-hmm. were kind of like emphasizing like this Irish like idea, mm-hmm. but you're totally like reeling it back, which I find like mm-hmm. very nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, Yeah, I mean, tourism has the ability to turn cultures, unfortunately, into stereotypes. And sometimes even local people will kind of capitulate to that. And kind of in the Irish case, you know, there's a lot of kind of shamrockery that goes on. You know, I mean, you're selling lots of, you know, floppy Guinness hats and, you know, I mean, you know, little leprechaun dolls and things like that. I mean, that can end up happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you sort of end up kind of capitulating to this almost kind of stereotyping that the tourists do of the culture, right? So that can happen. And even very respectful tourists and kind of tourism programs and tours, you know, can have that kind of effect, unfortunately. So there's this kind of very light, almost kind of joking kind of thing that goes on. And that's actually thinking about the Cliffs of Moher context. It's one of the things you see at the Cliffs of Moher is people joking about death and dying. So tourists, it's almost a compulsion, I think, for some tourists to joke about falling off the cliffs. They probably, you know, to their credit, don't know that that actually happens, maybe. That's the forgiving view. But you see a lot of tourists who pretend to be falling off the cliffs. There are many places where you can kind of crawl off part of a ledge and have somebody take a picture in such a way where the perspective makes it look like you're hanging off the edge. Or they'll jump in the air and have people take pictures of them. It's a very, very common kind of tourist behavior there. So there's almost a genre, I suppose, of joking that happens at the site that's very macabre. And, you know, even people who don't do that, I think you're kind of confronted with a sort of feeling of death and dying there, because it's such a dramatic drop. And really what you're looking at is stone, sea, and sky. It's very elemental. So I think it kind of evokes some of these elemental feelings in people.
We kind of have that draw to the edge, but
yeah,
then denying the actual jumping off. Thank you mentioned yeah. that. I found it really interesting how you talked about the tourism industry, especially trying to create meaning and ascribe it to the cliffs where there wasn't necessarily that meaning before. So could you talk a little bit about the tourism industry's kind of struggle to sell a certain image of the cliffs and of Irishness, and kind of maybe pushing the suicides under the rug, or trying to combat that, the joking and also the reality of suicides?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, geographers talk about and write about how you can think of land and landscape as two different concepts. So land is the actual physical geography of a place. But when humans infuse a place with meaning, when we kind of draw lines around certain geographies and label them and then give them stories, whether it's folklore or in this case, an interpretive center at this site that kind of has a narrative that they've constructed about it. I mean, you're kind of turning what is just, you know, land really on the one hand into something that has cultural meaning, which, you know, we might call landscape. And so what you see at the Cliffs of Moher is a number of narratives about what the site means that are running headlong into one another. And so in 2007, a new interpretive center was built at the site. Over 32 million euros it cost. It was a really expensive, lavish thing. And it's a very beautiful building. It's set completely into the hillside. So you kind of almost enter the landscape yourself as you walk into the site. And there are a number of kind of kiosks. It's, you know, it's an interpretive center. So there's a lot of, you know, information about the landscape. And it really emphasizes the natural landscape. It emphasizes the wildlife that's there. There are puffins that, you know, that nest on the side. There's all sorts of bird species and actually a pretty rich sea life out in the ocean. And so there's this real emphasis on the kind of purity and the ecological purity of the site. And people are only brought in as they talk about folklore and folk music, which is interesting. But the whole building is so modern that it also kind of projects this kind of new modern contemporary Ireland, you know. So on the one hand, they're talking about kind of folk culture And yet the building, the structure itself, really projects this very kind of postmodern, almost kind of architectural, you know, wealthy version of Ireland. So, you know, if we think about it that way, the Interpretive Center itself is trying to create a narrative or a set of narratives that are about kind of this ecological purity in this modern contemporary Ireland, you know, in this very positive sort of way. But of course, the fact of death and dying at the site kind of punctuates that kind of clean, leisurely, light narrative and, you know, presents its own very dark kind of narrative about the site. You know, and tourists themselves may or may not see that darker narrative. There are suicide hotline, you know, signs everywhere, and there are warning signs to stay away from the cliff edge. So some tourists go and they're kind of confronted with those signs. You see a lot of selfies online with people taking pictures with the warning signs, for example, kind of joking about that. So they are confronted with the idea that you could die, that there's risk involved here. And if they look at the suicide hotline, you know, signs, they might realize, oh my gosh, somebody has killed themselves here in the past, right? So going there for leisurely practices, and yet you're confronted with this kind of dark shadow over the site. So there are competing narratives, as you said, there's competing narratives about what this site means. And of course, if you tragically were a member of a family of somebody who completed suicide there, you know, that site has a totally different meaning for you than somebody who's on holiday, you know. So this is how landscapes are kind of created. And you can't really ever control a narrative. You know, there's never a single monologue that happens about a site. You know, one person's interpretation is always going to compete with other people's interpretations.
Do you think that the tourists who do kind of almost take it as like a joking, let me take a selfie with this sign, as like a way of coping, of kind of like pushing that mentally down within themselves?
Yeah, I think so. Christian said earlier that you sort of want to approach the edge, but you want to walk away from it, you know? And I think Fintan O'Toole's an Irish journalist who basically said the same thing. And that's kind of where I get the title from my particular chapter, That Awful Margin, because that's what he called it. And he said that you approach the edge, you almost feel compelled to approach the edge and kind of confront, you know, that awful margin of life and death and, you know, meaning and existence and all sorts of stuff. And you walk away refreshed because you've kind of rejected death for now, maybe, right? So, yeah, there's this very powerful kind of description he has of the site, which I think is true. Whether people really think that deeply about it or not, I think, you know, some people maybe subconsciously have that experience of the site, and that's why it's so dramatic. You know, you see people just staring out into the void at the site, and, you know, sometimes people are weeping, and it's a very powerful kind of experience to stand in front of this really dramatic landscape. So I think absolutely you're right. They're coping with it sometimes by joking about it, right? That's a common psychological move that we make in confronting things that we're very uncomfortable with, like our own deaths.
So you mentioned in your chapter two how the center has adopted one of the more popular signs, warning signs about suicide, as a t-shirt they sell. I think that's really interesting because it almost seems to undercut their message of trying to sell a certain narrative. Does that represent maybe their failing to create a singular narrative about the cliffs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the people who run the site and the director of the Interpretive Center would probably say, we're not trying to sweep it under the rug. We want to recognize it. In fact, you know, I've talked to people there who say more or less the same thing. Like, look, we need to recognize that this happens. They actually train all of their staff in suicide prevention so that if they see somebody acting in a certain way, they can kind of intervene and help. So they recognize it does happen. And if tourists, and this is a very common thing, tourists will often ask employees of the site, do people actually kill themselves here? They'll ask questions like that. And so they do acknowledge that it happens, but they don't want to emphasize it, obviously, in the narrative of, for example, the Interpretive Center itself. But yeah, they started making t-shirts with the warning sign on it. So they sell those at the Interpretive Center, basically because so many tourists were prying them off the walls as souvenirs. So they were bringing them home, which is terrible if you think about it, because, you know, that could actually cause, you know, risk of life and limb for some future tourists who... So they were putting these signs back up at such a rate. They thought, well, we have to make tourists. We kind of have to give in to this, you know, thing that tourists want, I guess. So
I cannot believe that, honestly.
Yeah.
That is so shocking.
There's a lot of shocking things about the whole juxtaposition, right? So one of the things we talk about in this book, and one of the reasons we think it's important to examine these strange juxtapositions of light and dark and leisure and death, is that especially in, and I'll put this in air quotes, Western cultures, you know, however you want to draw lines around that. But in the West, in the 20th century in particular, we've entered into this era of death denial. We kind of want to push our own deaths away from us. We do this in our funeral practices. You know, we embalm people, you know, in the United States anyway. That's a very common practice. If you think about that kind of embalming funeral practice and the sort of visitation you would have before the actual funeral ceremony, really the goal of that is to make the person look lifelike, you know. And we do this in our own lives too. We push death away from ourselves and our relatives and our friends. We don't want to think about it. And yet there's a corollary strange habit that we have, which is an obsession with other people's deaths, right? If you think about our pop culture and you think about, you know, sort of slasher horror films, or you think about, you know, zombie films even, we fantasize about death. We think about post-apocalyptic scenarios where our whole culture is dying even. We're obsessed with death in some ways. You know, Bones and CSI and all these television shows, you know, are almost kind of pornographic versions of death, where you're kind of zooming in on the wound and all this stuff. We love death when it's not ours, right? So we have this strange psychology that's developed, and it didn't used to be this way. Even in the 1700s and 1800s, you would die at home alone or with your family. You know, you would have wakes with the body in the home. Lots of cultures are very comfortable with death. So, you know, one of the points we want to make is that this is all around us anyway, and we should probably have a healthier relationship with death.
Is there anything in your research that you found as kind of like, what was the switch? What was the turn of events in which we treat death in such a weird way?
Well, in the U.S. context, it became quite an industry, actually. I mean, it is today a very big industry. If you think about the life stage rituals and ceremonies we spend a lot of money on. We spend a lot of money in the United States on weddings and funerals. These are really expensive rituals for us. So, you know, and it didn't used to be that way. You would have what we now call natural burials, of course. Today, bodies are pumped through with chemicals and we seal them in these, you know, very elaborate, expensive, silk-lined coffins, which are then sealed in a vault. Again, the idea is that you'll never decay, and then you're put into the ground. You know, obviously, other people choose to be cremated and all sorts of other things. But it became a very elaborate industry, and, you know, the tombstones and all sorts of stuff. So I think part of it is a kind of industrialization of death that we see in Western culture in general, but particularly American culture. Today, interestingly, you see a new movement, it's small, but growing, of kind of reversing that trend. People are moving back towards kind of more natural burials, where they don't get embalmed. They're maybe wrapped in natural biodegradable cloth or put into an unfinished pine box so that they can be... They can just, you know, be decomposed as quickly as possible. Because the truth is that cemeteries are actually pretty toxic places these days because they're so full of chemicals, really. So it's actually better for the environment and actually healthier maybe psychologically for ourselves if we come around to accepting our own deaths a little more.
Do you think that this research has kind of made you reflect on the way you think about death?
Yes. Yes, of course it has. I mean, like a lot of people in U.S. society, and I don't want to generalize, we live in a very mm-hmm. diverse society, but I didn't really confront a lot of the reality of my own death, really. And what it really means to think about your body and what happens to it after you're gone. And it's gotten me to want to have a natural burial, for example. After learning about all the different options and their impacts not only on my body, but also on the environment, on the family, on all sorts of things, it seems to me that that's really the healthiest way, at least for me. I'm not going to judge anybody else's choices, but yeah, it certainly got me to reflect over the course of the years that I've been doing this project about my own death. We definitely fear death. I think a lot of us just fear the dying process, if we're honest with ourselves. It's not maybe death we fear, it's dying, you know, and we often don't even tease those things out. And, you know, if we look cross-culturally, and this book really focuses on U.S. and European societies for the most part, but we do have some chapters that, you know, focus on Indonesia and other places around the world. And if you look at cultures around the world that have a much healthier relationship with death and dying and their ancestors, you see that they're pretty comfortable in some scenarios with the whole process. You know, so it doesn't have to be this way. This is one of the big lessons. We've socially constructed, you know, this way of dying and dealing with death and being afraid of it, but we don't have to fear it.
So do you think that fear of death that we have is connected to our interest in other people's deaths? Your book talks also about dark tourism.
Yeah, this is a growing area globally in tourism, which is to seek out sites of death and dying. And this can be anything from, you know, a very respectful tour, for example, of Auschwitz. You know, that would be an example of dark tourism. To visit a site where people have died, you can go to Ground Zero in New York City and in a respectful way kind of pay homage to those people, right? But you would also include things like a ghost walk tour, you know. For example, on that same trip with my wife, when we were touring around Europe after college, we went on a Jack the Ripper walking tour in London. We thought that would be really cool. And halfway through the tour, we're walking around from site to site where he had murdered these women. And we went to the pub where one of the women had her last pint and was last seen. And it was so horrifying. We wondered why we went on this tour and why we ever thought it was cool. But there are lots of examples of that, ghost walks and all sorts of dark tourism that's developing around the world. So, there's a lot of people who want to seek out those experiences and those sites for various reasons. So, yeah, that's a growing area of interest. And I think it does have to do with a fear of death and a sort of playing with death. There's a kind of macabre sort of toying with death and dying. And especially, again, the death of dying of others. You know, we don't much like it when it's our own. We don't want to think about it. We deny it. But when it's other people, unfortunately, we've developed this strange psychology where that's kind of fun or cool, right? And so, yeah, again, one of the points of our book is to kind of call that out a bit. Why is that cool? You know, I think it's pretty cold, actually. So, and what we see now is that this has all gone online. So there are horrible videos of, you know, executions. I mean, actually, when people have been executed and it's been filmed, you see these spikes in downloads of those things. So, yeah, I mean, I think there is a kind of horrible, I think it's a pretty horrible kind of celebration of other people's deaths sometimes. Yeah.
That's horrific, yeah.
Yeah, so some of that. I mean, I don't want to paint all dark tourism that way because, you know, going to Ground Zero, you know, can be a very respectful mm-hmm. kind of thing that's really important to you and, you know, maybe a sense of patriotism or something, or going to Auschwitz. I mean, it's important to have those sites around to remind us of the horrors of the past, right? So it can be educational. It can be, you know, there's lots of motives for that kind of tourism and the growth of it. But we do have to recognize that there is some pretty gruesome motives as well that people want. You know, why do you want to see these things? Why do you want to learn about this stuff? Is it a sense of respect or is it you're kind of, yeah, celebrating somebody's death? Yeah. So the book is available at the University of Colorado Press website for now. It'll be out in April of 2018, and it's also going to be available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, all the sort of usual websites. You can pre-order it if you want.
Do you recommend it to general students, people interested in anthropology, or who's the audience?
Yeah, the audience is... anthropologists. I mean, we are all anthropologists, I think, who are studying, who've written chapters in the book. So it does have an anthropological bent, but we expect it'll have a much broader appeal outside of anthropology. So certainly academics who are interested in leisure practices, tourism, certainly. Death studies is a whole interdisciplinary field. People study rituals and beliefs and practices and histories of death and dying. And certainly, you know, obviously at that professional level, graduate students and probably some, you know, undergraduates, they're taking a very specific class, I would imagine, on death and dying, maybe, or leisure practices. I don't know. Well, thanks very much. Yeah, it was really fun.
Thank you so much for being here and talking to us.
Yeah,
thanks. I hope you enjoyed it.
This episode of Lives of the Mind was hosted by Christian Elliott and Mara Carr, edited by Christian Elliott, and produced by Cyrus Sargar. Production manager is Ian Connolly-Keck, media coordinator is Mara Carr. Theme music was written by Caitlin Tom and performed by Caitlin Tom and Douglas Ganster. For more information on the Austin E. Knowlton Honors Program, go to www.augustana.edu/honors.